Welcome to Directions in the Study of Religion for Marginalia Radio. I'm your host, Christian Peterson.
Joining me today is Megan Goodwin. She's a Mellon Postdoctoral Fellow for Innovative and Creative Pedagogy in the Humanities at Bates College. And her research explores gender and sexuality, American religions, religious language and literature, minority religions, and contemporary critical thought. She's working on a current project called Good Fences, American Sexual Exceptionalism and Marginal Religions, which explores the ways normative sexuality has complicated American religious pluralism since the 1970s. But today she's here to speak to us about pedagogical innovation in religious studies. Welcome, Megan. How are you?
I'm very well. Thanks so much for having me.
You have a very exciting and I'm sure challenging position, even the title Innovative and Creative Pedagogy in the Humanities. It's a great title. Can you tell us about what this position is and what do you see as kind of the key goals of this professional mandate for creative teaching?
You know, it has been so exciting and really daunting because, again, the idea of innovation and creation and creativity, it's just enough rope to sort of hang myself. So the department has been wonderful. The college has been wonderful. The Mellon Foundation, bless their hearts, have given me all the space to sort of run with however I'm interpreting creativity and innovation. So for me, honestly, it's been a lot about experimentation and playing with these small class sizes and this reduced sort of teaching load. I have currently the best job in the world. I teach a 1-1. I have had classes as small as 3 people and will have a class this semester coming up the short term that's 40, but I never have more students than that. So I have this crazy, like, J.C. Smith level of time to be involved and playing around with what works and what doesn't. So that's been fantastic. A lot of what I found, honestly, is trying to tailor, you know, the funky, fun, creative approaches, the role-playing or the acting things out or the debates to students that are so smart and so engaged and are really willing to play along, but also are just really enthusiastic about talking about the material, which I sort of forgot happened. So, yeah, it's been dramatic poetry readings. It's teaching a class on religion and monsters as a way to do an intro to religion class. And it's been, you know, getting to teach in my area of expertise with all of the support you could possibly want. So very grateful and really excited.
Bates, it sounds like, is really a unique teaching experience. And I know you've taught at other places. Can you talk about what types of opportunities Bates has offered in terms of these bright, eager students and what the role of experimentation has been? And I guess how much would you say innovation is also has to do much with failing?
So let's start with the successes. the amazing, magical, one of the amazing, magical things about being in a place like Bates is, not to be crass, but it's resources. You know, I taught at a state school for 8 years and, you know, they tell you money makes a difference, but there's no way to realize what a difference it makes till you're here. And the nice part is you've got people who want to use those resources to not only improve the lives of the students, but also the community. So, and bring in those innovative pieces on campus and get students to work with tools that they never think to use. So just to give you an idea, this is what my morning was like this morning. I had a meeting with the woman named Holly Lasagna from the Harward Center, which is our center for community engaged learning, what used to be called service learning, except that makes it sound like a chore. So I'm teaching a class in American religions and politics next semester, trying to get my kids geared up for the primaries. And Holly and I were chatting about ways to have my students in the fall get out and get politically involved without being explicitly partisan. So we're talking about having them do voter registration or possibly work with the Maine People's something or another, so that they can get a sense of what it is to be politically active in the community as well as on campus. And then I had a meeting with Matt, one of our digital imaging guys, about getting to use the 3D printer for my kids' final project in the Religion and Monsters class. Their final assignment is to create their own monster and talk about why it's a monster, why it's religious, why would we be afraid of it, and how would we deal with this religiously. And we're using the 3D printer to print it out. So one, it's kind of encouraging this visual way of thinking and hopefully engaging some different learning styles. But it's also building things like algorithmic awareness. So they have to learn very basic, but some coding to be able to do this and get to play around, again, with technologies that might not occur to them otherwise. So, you know, Bates has these kinds of spaces and just has people that are so really excited to be here that it really does sort of leave me feeling like, you know, if you put in the time and you put in the energy, you really can do just about anything here. So
I'm jealous.
Yeah. I'm scared about having to leave.
Part of what makes your courses innovative is the content you cover, and you kind of hinted at some of the things you're doing. So can you tell us the types of courses you're teaching and where do you see them fitting into the study of religion and perhaps other religious studies programs? What's innovative about your course content?
Okay. A lot, I hope. So since I've been here, I've done a revamped version of my American Minority Religions class. It's called Goddesses, Guns, and Gurus. I tried it out at Elon the first go around, and I think it worked well. But one of the things I realized is that we do not teach our students American history after the late 19th, early 20th century. And if we're going to be talking about American minority religions, so much of that diversity comes in after 1965 with the Immigration Reform Act. So rather than go kind of thematically or tradition by tradition, which is what I did with the original version of Goddesses, Guns, and Gurus, I built in the American history piece, condensed the timeline. So we only talked about American minority religions from 1945 forward. And I also built in some primary source material that wasn't explicitly religious, but gave them a sense of what the political climate in the United States was at the time we were talking about it. So it made for some really interesting conversation partners. It would not, I think, have occurred to me to have Mary Daly in conversation with like Allen Ginsberg before I was designing the syllabus, but it made the conversations a lot richer. And I was excited about that. And the students seemed to enjoy it. This was also the group that halfway through the semester told me to stop using all of the gimmicks and just let them talk about the books. This semester, I just finished a religion and sexuality class. I taught this, 4 or 5, yikes, years ago at UNC. And when I taught it there, it was modeled on my advisor syllabus. It was a lot of the sort of canonical stuff. And it was a great class. I'm still in contact with a number of those students, but it wasn't the model that I wanted to pursue when I got here. So what I did when I was pulling this course together was think about, all right, well, what are the conversations that are happening right now? A lot of my pedagogy is modeled around creating, it sounds trite, but I mean it, global citizens. So I take very seriously the thought that my students might never take another religious studies class, but they are potential voters, right? So I want them to be informed about the different ways religion, gender, sexuality inform things that affect not only their daily lives, but the daily lives and the ongoing experience of fellow citizens. So if you're going to be voting on things like gay marriage or contraception, I want you to know what the history of those debates are and why you should care, right? So the religion and sexuality class I did this time had less kind of Audre Lorde and less kind of reclaiming LGBTQ church history. And instead I went global, which is not a thing I am particularly comfortable with, but was I think productively challenging both for me and for the students. And I went really contemporary. So the conversations we were having were about, you know, the Hobby Lobby Supreme Court decision and what the RFRA means, Religious Freedom Restoration Act. We looked at sexual reassignment surgery in Iran. We looked at evangelization in Uganda and how American evangelicals really informed that situation. We looked at sex positive evangelicals and Amy DeGregatis's fantastic book. Clergy, sex abuse, all of the things that have kind of been in the news in the last 5 years, so that they were still pertinent, they were at least vaguely familiar to the students that I was talking to, you know, here and now. which was great, but also really challenging because nobody's an expert in these areas yet. You know, there are some really smart essays, but there are very few monographs, say, on clergy sex abuse. Smart people are thinking about it. Katie Lofton, Kent Brittenell, Robert Orsi, obviously. But there's no sort of, this is the way we teach this. So a lot of it is kind of feeling things out and seeing what works, which was incredibly rewarding. But also I realized after the fifth week of atrocities, I need to find a way to break it up a little bit because it sort of just wears on you. And then this semester, I'm looking at Religion and Monsters, which developed, well, one, out of an enthusiasm for the material, but also I've been in conversations with my chair, Marcus Bruce, all semester about where Bates as a religious studies department wants to go. And one of the things they're kind of thinking about is kind of building in more structure and thinking about scaffolding people toward the writing of their religious studies senior thesis. Everybody at Bates writes a senior thesis. And right now that can look very, very different depending on whose classes you're taking. So this was a way to kind of work in core religious studies concepts, things like gender, power, belief, ritual, without doing the sort of hallowed recitation of the names of great white men. Next semester, it's election, American politics. And then after that, still in debate. I'm thinking about an American Islam class, but we'll see. So
now I know your own research is theoretically rich. And I think this is a problem that a lot of people have. How do you incorporate theory? So can you talk a little bit about how you bring theory into the classroom? And perhaps related to this would be interdisciplinary nature of religious studies. I know you're very conversant in cultural studies and gender studies, sexuality studies. How do you bring these fields in conversation with key figures from religious studies in your classroom?
So, the theory question is tricky. I wound up as an Americanist by accident, mostly because while there are very, very few jobs in American religions, there are no jobs in religion and culture or religion and theory. So I needed to find a way to make my work marketable. And one of the realities of that market is realizing that there is a big chunk of American religious studies that is really resistant to theory. And this obviously isn't the entire field. There are some people that are doing really smart American religions and theory work. Jason Bivens is the first person that comes to mind, but there are absolutely others. So, you know, different people have different takes on this. For me, the way theory guides my research is in the asking of questions that are informed by critical theorists that think smarter things than I do about power and gender and religion. But I have stopped doing I'm going to do 25 pages of analysis on what Foucault means by becoming homosexual and whether or not that's relevant because, well, nobody cares but me. In terms of how the kind of cultural theory informs my work, again, I think it's the questions that I'm asking and hopefully the power imbalances that I'm paying attention to, which is not to say that, you know, I'm unique in this, but I do think, well, all right, I'll give you an example. So Mike Altman and I, 2 or 3 years ago, wound up in the same 5 or 6 panels in a row where we're just at the AAR and we're at all the American religions panels over and over and over again. And after the 4th or 5th panel, he leaned over to me and said, look, I figured this out. You only have one question. We're in every room and all you're doing is saying, what about women? And I said, I swear to God, Mike, when somebody else starts asking the question, I will ask something else. So it's been a lot for me of feeling like I'm asking what are really basic theoretical questions, but things that could really, I hope, inform richer religious studies work. And again, I don't think I'm alone there, but I do think engaging gender theory, sexuality theory, post-colonial theory, a lot of the things that a lot, I think, of younger scholars are getting into, really helps broaden religious studies and the kind of work that we're trying to do out in the world.
What are some of the creative activities or assignments you're doing in class? What are some successful strategies you've had for student engagement?
Sure. I mean, that's the best part. So the things that I found that the students respond most to are things that will involve kinetic elements and collaboration. So the we're going to pick out a chunk from the Bible. I do this a lot with creation myths. We're going to act out, you know, competitive creation myths. And how do the Babylonians tell this story? How do the Jews tell this story? What's the Christian spin on this story? And they love that. It's surprising to me finding that different audiences will respond to different things. So an activity that worked particularly well at UNC doesn't always land here in the same way. No one was really that invested in talking about, well, snake handling was just completely an oddity here. Whereas, you know, if we're talking about snake handling and what that looks like in North Carolina, people were talking about, no, this is my experience with snake handling, which was really interesting. Other things that have worked here, I did do a dramatic reading of Allen Ginsberg. They got really into that, which surprised me because I felt kind of like a dork, but they dug it. Like, we turned the lights off and I lit a candle and talked about putting my queer shoulder to the wheel, which was great. And then it was funny. I found an audio recording of Ginsberg reading that poem, and he does it completely differently and as a much funnier piece than I did. Oh, well. I was really excited about the Martin Luther King, Malcolm X debate. I made them dig up primary sources on the question of what American religion is and what it should be from the perspective of Malcolm X and Martin Luther King, and they divided into teams. And I thought this was so fun, and they did it, but I think they really struggled around talking about issues of race in ways that I had not anticipated, which might have something to do with it. Bates is surprisingly diverse for a small liberal arts college, but it is still a small New England liberal arts college. So not as much diversity as some other classrooms that I've been in. The thing that they liked the most in the American Minority Religions class was I set up an imaginary mediation session based on a real court case in California in the 70s, where a girl, 14-year-old girl, had run away to join the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, so the Hare Krishnas. And she was brought back. She ran away again, came back on her own. And then her mother sued ISKCON for, God, millions and millions of dollars, and originally won the case and then lost it. And so we had people speaking on behalf of the girl, on behalf of her family, on behalf of her psychologist, on behalf of the Krishnas. And then I had a couple people weigh in as, you know, academic experts. So they were all kind of pulling from the readings, the primary sources, and the scholarly analysis of the case. And they got so into it. They loved that. All of the evaluations talked about how much they loved that. This semester, my approach was a little bit different. I was really trying to challenge myself to do fewer sources and get more in depth. So we read a lot more actual theory than I have done in many years. Like, we sat down and read Bersani's Is the Rectum a Grave? We really dug into Gail Rubin, and that was really rewarding. And I struggled with feeling as though I were being innovative in doing this very slow, very methodical, you know, really deliberate, close reading. But we worked in some fun stuff too. When we were talking about evangelicalism and sex, we read Amy DeRogatis's piece after we looked at a graphic novel called Blankets, which talks about a guy sort of losing his faith as he's embracing his sexuality. And again, as a way to sort of think visually, I had them kind of impromptu draw out one scene that kind of stuck out. And then we did critiques of what came out of these drawings and what stuck out about religion and sexuality based on just what they had remembered off the top of their heads. So that wound up being really fun. A lot of collaborative timelines. I love a timeline. And then, like I said, next semester, the end of the course is they're creating their own monsters. So we're using the 3D printer that Bates has. See, again, resources. And they, in groups, will make their own monster and then actually get to print out their own monster and present it to the class. So I'm really excited about that.
Yeah, that sounds great. I'm wondering, just to kind of finish up here, if you could talk a little bit about control. Successful classrooms are very much tied to the professor's role. But what do we gain by letting go of the reins? Can we foster innovation and creativity when we let students lead? Is that a successful way to be creative in the classroom?
I think that is both a really important question and probably my own personal kryptonite. And it's definitely something that I'm I'm trying to work on while I'm here. So I am a type A teacher, and while I love participation, it's very hard for me to let them lead the conversation, or for the conversation, honestly, to go in directions that I hadn't anticipated. But I am, and again, this might be location specific, but I am learning to trust my students both to have done the work and to take us in areas sometimes that I haven't even thought of. The one that I keep coming back to is the Dennis Covington conversation. This is a book about snake handling in Appalachia. And I've taught that book five times now. And I have set questions because I want to make sure that we get to all of the things. And I started with that here. And within the first 5 minutes, the students just rebelled and said, no, this was so interesting. We have to talk about these things. And they were, once I took a deep breath and let that happen, they were pointing out things. It was hard. It's really hard for me. They were pointing out things that, frankly, I had never even really paid attention to. They were making some really adept, particularly racial critiques of the work that I just had never delved into, because that book is so much about religion and gender for me. So trusting that they're going to do the work, and that even if we don't get to every single thing that I think is so very important, the students should be trusted, or again, at least at Bates, to take us in directions that are really rewarding. So I am trying to breathe slow and let them do it. Great. Still hard. I'm still struggling, but so far it's working out okay.
Well, Megan, thanks for your time, and good luck with the rest of your appointment. I hope you really soak it in while you're there.
I'm trying. Thanks again.